And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, I've got a pretty exciting deal to tell you guys about. In fact, it's the best deal we've ever given to new subscribers. If you're listening to this, you at least know a little bit about The Athletic and what we do here. We are setting a new bar for sports coverage, and we have names like Robert Mays, Jason Stark, Ken Rosenthal, Lindsey Jones, and more. You know that we're telling the stories that no other outlets can, and recently, we've run some pretty incredible stories on the Ben Simmons saga by Sam Amick and where things stand. Joe Varden just wrote a really cool piece on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and the rebuild that's happening in Oklahoma City. Will Guillory is writing about Zion Williamson and his ramp up. You can always read Fred Katz on the Knicks. There's just so much at The Athletic that you can't get anywhere else. So what I'm saying is you already know The Athletic is worth it. Well, right now, in honor of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, you can lock in our very best price, our deal of the year. It's $1 a month for 12 months. Go to theathletic.com/NBA show before midnight on Monday the 29th and lock in our very best price. Again, it's $1 a month for a whole year. So go ahead and get the sports coverage you know that you deserve, because it won't get any better than this.
Welcome to the Saturday Slammin' Jam, hosted by Andrew Schlecht with Alex Spears.
How about we can just watch basketball?
That's a man's jam!
I like that idea.
Live from Oklahoma.
Quick clip!
With questions and participants from all around the world.
Anthony Edwards!
Put that on a poster!
Whether you're flipping your flapjacks, tending to your yard, or just sipping your coffee, get ready, sit back, relax. It's the Saturday Slammin' Jam.
Fact is, I missed this shot. I'll walk away. I'm still a chump.
Here's Andrew.
Welcome to the Saturday Slammin' Jam. I'm your host, Andrew Schlecht. You can go to theathletic.com/NBA show and get The Athletic for a discounted rate. Alex, it's been a really, really fun week in the NBA. Tell us what happened.
Andrew, let's jump in the Wayback Machine and go through what happened this week. It all started last Friday night when the Sacramento Kings lost to the Oklahoma City Thunder 103-105. The Kings have lost five of their past six, and there are now reports that Luke Walton's job may be in jeopardy. The Kings front office have noticed something in these first 15 games that wasn't apparent after Walton took a 39-win team under Dave Yeager and led them to consecutive 31-win seasons with the league's worst defense last season. One night after a nice win over the Lakers, the Minnesota Timberwolves responded by sleepwalking through a 129-102 loss to the Los Angeles Clippers on Saturday night, a game which featured a strange sequence in which Karl-Anthony Towns began walking back on defense before teammate Anthony Edwards had even shot the ball. A lot of people saw this as a sign of dysfunction, but I say, why not see it as evidence of Kat's newfound commitment to defense, Andrew? The Wolves would finish the week with two straight wins over the Kings and Spurs. On Sunday night, the Atlanta Hawks snapped a six-game losing streak in style, defeating the Bucks 120-100. It was the start of a three-game winning streak that also included wins over the Magic and Celtics. It wasn't all good news, though, as Monday we learned that Hawks forward DeAndre Hunter will need surgery on his wrist with an expectation he will miss 8 weeks. This is Hunter's second significant injury in as many seasons, further complicating what was already a strange start to the season for the Hawks. On Monday night, the Bulls defeated the Lakers 121-103 behind 38 points from DeMar DeRozan. It was the Bulls' 10th win of the season, while the Lakers fell to 8-8 two nights later after a loss to the Bucks. The silver lining for Lakers fans is that Talen Horton-Tucker has absolutely looked the part in his first three games back, and LeBron is reportedly 50-50 to return Friday night against Boston. And if not then, probably Sunday night. On Tuesday night, we had the marquee matchup of the season, Warriors versus Nets, Steph versus KD. KD had spent the entire day of the game liking quote retweets of people who were dunking on a Dieter Kurtenbach article about how the Warriors were winning the breakup with KD. Was a classic KD game in the works? No! Much like KD's time in Golden State, all anyone cared about was Steph Curry on Tuesday, who hit 9 threes on his way to 37 points while receiving MVP chants from the Brooklyn Unfaithful. On Wednesday night, the Magic got their fourth win of the season and their second win over the New York Knicks. The Knicks are now 8-7. More concerning is their starting lineup, which has played more minutes together than any other five-man unit in the league and currently has a negative 16.3 net rating. And finally, on Thursday night, the Miami Heat beat the Washington Wizards 112-97 and are now on a four-game winning streak that also includes a win in Utah over the Jazz. As we record on Friday afternoon, the Miami Heat are the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. What a week it was, Andrew.
It's quite a week, Al. And when I sat down to kind of figure out what I wanted to talk about, I sent you a text saying that I wanted to talk about two-way contracts. And just like
weird. I thought to myself, weird. Why does he want to talk about two ways?
You know, like shout out PJ Dozier. Shout out Gary Payton II.
Mm-hmm.
But listen, it really was just a vehicle to try to talk about Lou Gehrig's Dort is all that it was. I was in person for the Lou Dort steal and finish at the rim against Sacramento and Oklahoma City in their all white Hanes underwear uniforms.
Right.
And I saw him blow up the other night against the Rockets for 34 in a game where you have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and you have phenom Jalen Green. Lou Dort was the best player on the floor that night. And so there's something happening with Lou Dort this season. He has developed quite a bit and has become a better finisher at the rim. I interviewed him before the season started and asked him, my first question was, how's your summer? And then what did you work on over the summer? And his first, like, he just went right out and said, it's finishing at the rim. Like, that's what I worked on. And it's paying off for him significantly. In the restricted area this season, he's shooting 63.6%, which is great. And you look at guys who have attempted about the same amount that he has in the restricted area. He has the same number of attempts that LaMelo Ball has. He has the same number of attempts in the restricted area that De'Aaron Fox has. And both those guys are shooting 56% to his 63%. Now, we're still early, but the way he's finishing makes me feel like it's sustainable. He's finishing with his strength. He's getting his chest into guys, and he's getting all the way to the rim. And also something that Mark Degnault talked about last season that he really struggled with was footwork and then the gather. And he seems to have cleaned that up quite a bit. So it's just been cool to see him go from a player that was undrafted. I mean, you look at where he was in mock drafts to start. So in January, he was supposed to be like around the 24th pick. That's where Sam Vecenie had him in his mock draft. It's a pretty easy guy to scout. Physical, tough, great defender, struggles on offense. Like, not a point guard. And because of his size, you kind of want him to be a point guard. Then on the day of the draft, he's mocked at 36. And he goes undrafted, largely because he doesn't have the ability to shoot the basketball. Like, when you would watch him at Arizona State, the ball would go out of the shot of the camera, up and then back down. It was so high arcing. And that it started out the same when he got to the NBA, frankly. It wasn't that different. But he ends up getting signed by the Thunder. I asked him, did you get to choose the Thunder? Because what's funny about Lou Dort and what's funny about some of these younger guys that I hadn't really even conceptualized this yet, but Lou Dort grew up a Thunder fan. He grew up a Russell Westbrook fan, which, I mean, the guy grew up in Montreal, Quebec. He didn't speak English until he was a sophomore in high school. He ended up going to a high school in Florida, didn't speak any English, but was so enamored with Russell Westbrook that he became a Thunder fan around the age of like 12, 13 years old. And so he gets to come to this franchise, Russell Westbrook is actually traded within like a few like weeks of Lou signing his two-way with the Thunder. So he misses opportunity to play with his favorite player. But it's just interesting because he talked about how he didn't really choose the Thunder. The Thunder ended up calling his agent. And I think he's ended up changing agents since then. But called his agent and he was thrilled to, you know, to get an opportunity. And then didn't get an opportunity for a while. He played for the Blue for a while. It wasn't apparent that this guy was going to be a pro from the get-go. And once they brought him in, though, I don't know how much you remember of like the first like few games of Lou Dort. It just was obvious that this is an NBA guy, like an obvious that he's an NBA defender.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you saw it from his very first game that he had an NBA skill.
And then you get to the playoffs in the bubble. And Lou contributes at such a high level on the defensive end. It was just honestly astonishing what he was able to do. Because he guarded the most difficult player to guard in the NBA in James Harden. Better than almost anybody we've seen. And we've seen guys guard him. Andre Roberson has been one of the better defenders of James Harden in his career. And not only did he do that, he scored 30 in a game seven where, I mean, this is definitely this is like the definition of like make or miss league when we saw him in this game, because it was Lou all alone. He took 12 threes in this game. He made six of them, ended up with 30 points in that game. And it felt like kind of an anomaly at the time. It didn't feel like that's something that he will replicate anyways, like in a regular season next year. Well, he ends up getting better. He scores 40 in a game last season. Now he's on this tear where he's scored at least 20 points in the last five games, in which these aren't games where Shea's sitting out. These aren't games where Josh Giddey doesn't have the ball. These are games where he's filling in the gaps and finding ways to score. And he's developing right before our very eyes into not only a great defensive player, but one of the better two-way players in the NBA. And at the age of 22, the Thunder obviously are rebuilding. They're trying to build through the draft. They want more draft picks. They want their own draft picks to convey as high lottery picks. But when you talk about everybody just wants to talk about Shea, and there's a great article today in The Athletic about Shea that you should go check out. But Lou Dort should be mentioned right there. And Josh Giddey is exciting. He's new. It's great. But Lou Dort should also be talked about when we talk about the development of this Thunder team. And he deserves a little bit of shine. So big shouts to Lou Dort.
Well, you didn't even mention the craziest stat, which you had brought this up to me. Last year in 52 games, Lou Dort, who you think of as like a strong, explosive dude, has seven dunks total. Seven dunks. This year, through 13 games, he has 15 dunks. Yeah. And man, dunking helps you boost that percentage around the rim a lot.
It has helped a lot. And not only that, he's averaging 17 points per game right now, which if he's not technically a part of the draft class because he wasn't drafted, but we'll include him in it. He'd be fifth in scoring in the 2019 draft class for this season, which is wild to me, which says a little bit about the draft class, right? But it also says a lot about the work that Lou has put in. It's not just the defense. The fact that he's averaging 17 points per game. And now, is it sustainable? I kind of doubt it. I think that he'll probably settle in closer to 15 points per game. But if he's 15 points per game, shooting a decent number from the field, finishing at the rim, he'll probably end up shooting about 32-ish percent from three on the season. Like, this guy's going to get paid. He's going to get paid at the end of this, and I believe the Thunder will be the team to pay him.
You look back at that draft, the 2019 draft, that second round, I mean, Talen Horton Tucker, because if we're grouping him in with the second rounders, Talen Horton Tucker, Terrence Mann, having those two guys as second rounders, and then there's other guys like Daniel Gafford, Alan Smaljic, that was his year.
Yeah.
but there's other players in here, Isaiah Roby, Bol Bol, who are actually getting some minutes on NBA teams. It was a good second round.
Yeah. And all those guys, what they have in common is that nobody really thought they could shoot. Like, that's what most of those guys are. Like, all those guys are defensive minded guys, have a high motor, and like, those guys can still be successful. And now that you have these rule changes where the one-on-one defense or defense on the perimeter, it matters even more than it did last season. Last season, you could still trick anybody, even Lou, even the most disciplined of defenders. But now that you can't do all those little tricks to get free throws, it's even more important to have a good perimeter defender. That's why it's more important to have a Terrence Mann or a Lou Dort out there, because you can actually make a bigger impact now that they've changed the rules.
All right, Andrew. What I want to talk about this week is the Houston Rockets.
What?
Who wants to talk about the 1-14 Houston Rockets? Me! But I want to start by telling you what I'm not here to talk about. I'm not here to talk about how they're an embarrassment to the league, how they should be playing John Wall, how their starting lineup is 10 points per 100 possessions worse than the second worst starting lineup. I don't care about any of that stuff because I get what they're doing. They owe picks to OKC beginning in 2024. They have these next two seasons to maximize their draft haul. Jalen yep. Green and their own picks this season and next are likely what will ultimately decide their ceiling. They are incentivized to be bad, and as a Thunder fan, I fully support their plan. And all the worrywarts in the national media who are concerned about the long-term effects of being this bad will be the same people fawning over their young core if they enter next season with Jalen Green and Paolo Banchero as their foundation for the future.
Sure.
Now, all that said, there are many ways to get where the Rockets want to go this season, and I'm somewhat confused by the way they're going about it.
Yeah.
If you are completely lost in life and spent some of your fleeting time on this earth watching the Rockets lose to the Thunder this week, you saw a stark contrast in how the two franchises are going about developing their young players. You would have no idea watching that game that Houston drafted four players in the first round of what looks like an incredible draft. And while Jalen Green had his normal minutes and looked good offensively in a tough matchup against Lou Dort, Alperen Şengün, the big man they traded two first-round picks for in last year's draft, only played 5 minutes. Meanwhile, Josh Christopher was a DNP CD. Usman Garuba is in the G League. After the game, Rockets head coach Steven Silas said that he couldn't get minutes for Şengün because Daniel Theis was playing so well, to which I would respond, who cares? Şengün, in my opinion, is already one of the best players on this team, and developing him should be the number two priority behind Jalen Green. Even KJ Martin, their second-year player, who was one of the few bright spots last season, only got 12 minutes in this game. At one point in the fourth quarter, KJ was in a lineup featuring DJ Augustine, Daniel Theis, Eric Gordon, and Garrison Matthews. What the hell is that? No one wants to see that. You're 1-14. You're not fooling anyone into thinking this is a functional basketball team. And if the argument is that the young guys need to earn their minutes, let's be honest, who really deserves their minutes when you're 1-14? So, yeah. If you're at rock bottom, and you are, what should be the goal? Because if it wasn't clear already, you're getting a top pick, whether you play your vets or your young guys. So throw that goal out. Success! You did it! It's happening no matter what you do. But who is benefiting from having to watch DJ Augustine and Daniel Theis run pick and rolls for a 1-14 team in the fourth quarter of a game against the Oklahoma City Thunder? Not me. I don't think Rockets fans are benefiting. Obviously, Alperen Şengün isn't benefiting. And I don't think Steven Silas is benefiting. You just got beat by the Thunder playing your vets. And it's not like this team doesn't have young talent. And it's not like this team has had literally any success with their current approach. So what are we doing? And listen, I know one argument is going to be that they need to showcase these guys for trades, which I generally don't buy the idea of showcasing guys. It seems like most teams would have years of scouting on the Rockets' vets, even though I'd like to imagine some scout is out there just absolutely buzzing after watching Daniel Theis's 24 minutes against the Thunder like it's some revelation. We got to get this guy. But to be fair, I do think there are exceptions. And Eric Gordon might be one of those exceptions because coming into this season, Eric Gordon's contract looked like an untradeable albatross. Including this season, he has 3 years left at around $20 million per year. Hadn't shot it above 33% from three since Chris Paul was on the team. And it was fair to wonder if he was ever going to bounce back. The fact he's currently shooting 46% from three on around five attempts per game is awesome for Houston, and it's not insane to think he could get some serious trade interest from contenders. So in his case, sure, showcase away. Broadly speaking, though, I think it's time for this team to prioritize getting their young guys real NBA minutes. Again, you are 1-14. It's over. It's over. You have young talent now. You also have four first-round picks over the next two drafts. Just more young guys who will need minutes as well. You can't waste a year giving minutes away to vets who will not impact your team's future. Act like a team that traded away their superstar for picks and then drafted four first-rounders. Please, Houston, what are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, the Sengun argument is the one that kills me the most because he was supposed to be like ready to contribute right away. A guy that can come in and get buckets. He can rebound. He can do all these things. And you're right. Like the gap between he and Daniel Theis, like there really shouldn't be one with regards to minutes. It is really pretty crazy. I mean, they should be doing something closer with the Thunder are doing. They're starting Jeremiah Robinson Earl and playing him 24 and a half minutes a game and giving him valuable minutes. Like how do you teach Alperen Sengun to do the right things if you don't see him do anything?
Well, and the crazy thing is, like, I would still believe this even if Sengun was playing horribly. Like, even if they had thrown him out early in the season, he was playing terrible. And to be fair, like, he's averaging 18 minutes per game. So it's like they're still playing him, but he's been good. Like, the Darko guys out there who have their Darko rookie projections, like, Alperen Sengun has been at the top of those Darko projections. And you even see it when he's on the floor because we've talked about how this team doesn't really have a true point guard. But you can imagine a scenario where a few years down the road, like Sengun could potentially develop into one of those offensive hubs who's, you know, passing out, kind of like a Domantas Sabonis or something like that.
Sure.
I just feel like, why not invest in that right now? Like, what is this Daniel Theis thing? And listen, he did play well against the Thunder. Like, he was fine, but who cares? Who cares? What are you guys doing?
He was good enough for them to lose by 12.
Yeah, exactly. Like, whatever. I'm just disappointed because legitimately, if I was a Rockets fan after that draft, I mean, I would have been on cloud nine. Cloud nine. Four first round picks. You're thinking, oh my gosh, I don't care if we lose this year. I'm going to go watch a bunch of young guys. And then you're not even getting, you're getting basically to see Jalen Green and then occasionally Alperen Sengun. You don't get to see Josh Christopher and Usman Garuba. And you're barely getting to see KJ Martin, who was good last year. It's just very frustrating. I'm frustrated for Rockets fans.
Frustrated for Thunder, for Rockets fans too, because now you've got Thunder homers on Twitter saying, Shea over Jalen Green, Jeremiah Robinson Earl over whoever else you want to pick, Trey Mann over this guy, Josh Giddey over that guy. You know, like, because the Thunder, after their draft, like, we know how we felt. It was like, wow, that was really disappointing. What a disappointing time for the Oklahoma City Thunder. And it's looking pretty good for them right now, and it's probably just because they're playing their guys.
It is, because again, like, we all know where this is headed with Houston, whether they play their vets or their young guys. And if they come into next season with Jalen or Jalen and Paolo or Jalen and Chet, like, no one's going to care what happened this year either way. Yeah. But it's like, just play the young guys so you can start developing some foundation of how the guys might play together. Because if there was one criticism of Houston's draft, it was that, how did these guys all going to work together? Like, in a vacuum, draft experts liked all the individual picks, but they didn't necessarily like the collection of players. And I think you have to start figuring that out now, because like I said, there's more first-round picks that are going to be coming in. So you're going to have to know who you're drafting, how those are going to be fitting with those guys. So, I think it's going to happen. They're probably going to trade away Eric Gordon, probably going to trade away some of these other older guys. But, you know, 1-14, start now. Start now. It's great. Eric Gordon can shoot. Great. We saw it. Okay. He's done.
Oh, you speak of the Rockets figuring stuff out. The Pacers are another team that's just trying to figure things out. And we're going to talk about the Pacers right after this quick break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Andrew, it is once again time for the Wheel of Fandom, where we spin a digital wheel each week. It lands on a random team, and we become fans of that team for the next week. This week, the Wheel of Fandom landed on the Indiana Pacers. After what had been an up-and-down season thus far, things were looking up. When we spun the wheel last Friday, the Pacers were coming off their best win of the season against the Jazz in Utah. They followed that up with a win against the Sixers on Saturday. Had the Pacers finally turned the corner? Well, if they did, it was into a brick wall. The Pacers lost to the Knicks on Monday after scoring only 10 points in the fourth quarter, and on Wednesday, the Pacers had arguably their worst loss of the season, a 97-89 defeat to the 4-win Detroit Pistons. The Pacers are now 6-10, 13th in the East, 14th in offense, 17th in defense. Andrew, if the Pacers are our Wheel of Fandom team this week, who is our guest?
Our guest today is Caitlin Cooper, who is easily one of the smartest basketball people that I know. Like, when every time I read anything she writes, I get smarter. Anytime I listen to her on a podcast, I get smarter. So you guys are in for a treat. Caitlin, how's it going?
Doing well. I'm afraid now that people are going to hear me and be like, what was he talking about? She doesn't know anything.
Stop it. Stop it. You're great. We're so glad to have you on the show. The Pacers are one of the most confusing teams in the league currently. What are some of the major issues, in your opinion, that are contributing to this disappointing start?
I'm glad that you acknowledge that they're confusing and realize the difficulty of my job. I think just statistically, I don't think that they can be a team that turns the ball over all the time and also never gets to the free throw line and fouls all the time. Those are three pretty recurrent things. And when they go through like these long scoring droughts, like what you're mentioning, they had 10 points in the fourth quarter against the Knicks. They had 10 points over the final 10 minutes against the Pistons. A lot of times when you look at their shot charts, like in both those games, I felt like defensively what those two teams were doing impacted them quite a bit. The Knicks were really extending their pressure. They put Alec Burks on Malcolm Brogdon, and the Pistons were blitzing Malcolm Brogdon, which put them into different spaces, especially when they didn't have Chris Duarte to be spacing the floor. I mean, you could see in the game against the Knicks that they were helping off TJ McConnell, even in the strong side corner, and going on to Brogdon's drive. So I understand that because of the amount of injuries that they've had, that creates workarounds. But at the same time, I don't think that, you know, not having Chris Duarte and TJ Warren should be impacting you so much that you can't score 90 points against the Detroit Pistons. So a lot of times when they go through those laws and you look at the shot charts, there it'll be a lot of missed threes, very little in the paint. They're not going to get to the line a lot. And then it becomes a question too of, which I had a thread on this today that people can look at, especially against the Pistons, because it just so happened that my broadcast, the game commentary wasn't on. All you could hear was the arena sounds. So they get late into the games, and Rick Carlisle thinks they need to be a team that goes defense into offense. He mentioned that, you know, too often we were taking the ball out of the net, then we're having to come down against a Pistons team that's really aggressive, that was playing harder than us. And while I don't disagree with that, you can hear when they're grabbing the defensive rebound that he's literally telling them to hold it, hold the ball. Like, slow it down. And I understand, like, last year under Nate Bjorkman, they were a very fast-paced team. And sometimes that was slapdash and it hurt their defense. And you don't want to get into a track meet in every game. But when you're having trouble scoring in the half court, I think sometimes you need to let loose of the reins a little bit. And I thought that showed up in both of those two losses this week.
I wanted to ask you about Sabonis, because on a recent episode of the Indy Cornrows podcast, you talked about his changing shot distribution. Fewer post-ups compared to last season, slightly more threes, fewer free throws. You even mentioned that he's taking fewer post-up possessions than Kristaps Porzingis did in his last year with Rick Carlisle. How much of this is a deliberate change in his offensive role under Carlisle versus some small sample variance?
Oh, I think a lot of it is. I mean, what's interesting is a lot of people brought up the quote that Rick Carlisle had several years ago whenever he was asked about post-ups and Porzingis and said, you know, do you still feel that way about the post-up? And at the time, I figured, like, that's just having to relate to Kristaps Porzingis. Like, he and Sabonis are such different players. Rick Carlisle is an assistant coach. That will likely change when he comes here. When he was asked, that's effectively what he said. He said the post-up is a difficult play type in our league today, but there are certain players like Luka Doncic, like Anthony Davis. I don't remember who else he mentioned, but he said Sabonis is a good post-up player. We're going to use him there. And to start the season, you can see the de-emphasis there. Like, he's still getting shots in the restricted area, but when you watch their games, a lot of times it'll be because he's out on the perimeter and then he's having to dribble into it against a collapsed defense. Or, you know, if both Malcolm and Karras are available, it helps because then you have downhill playmakers. And I did think it was going to be a good thing when compared to last year. If you could reduce his post-up frequency a bit and get him more on the roll and get him in the middle of the floor. But they moved him to the high post, and now they've kind of shifted that high post split cut to him on the wing with split cuts there. It's a lot about where his touches are originating. Like I said, like, I mean, even in that game against the Sixers, when they did play really well, they shot 70% in the first half. An example I would give is, I don't have a problem with him shooting threes. I think it makes him a more complete player. And certainly if teams are leveraging him out there, or if you're wide open in the corner, it's damaging in today's NBA if you don't take an open corner three. But they called a play, I believe, in the third quarter. I mean, you could see Rick Carlisle signal for it, for him to be in the pick and pop and to shoot a pick and pop three, like, quicken the shot clock. Those types of possessions, I don't really understand. I feel like it's letting the defense off the hook. I mean, he's had games where he's hit, you know, three threes. I think he made three against the Knicks, but the defense doesn't really respond to it. They're not going to come out there and stretch it. Whereas, and I wrote an article about this week, the amount of inverse gravity that he has and the amount of teams that are really swarming him, like when they played the Raptors, they would send, you know, three, four bodies toward him. That it makes more sense to me to be having him down there and be getting the ball in a controlled setting, because Caris LeVert mentioned against the Pistons, like, some of our turnovers came from trying to enter the ball into the post. And that's true. They probably did have like five or six of their 14 first half turnovers as a result of that to he and Turner. But it's more so because they're not really doing anything to establish position for those two bigs. They're just like, hey, run down the floor, get ahead and duck in, and then have to hold off that guy for 5 or 6 seconds until a guard finally gets in the mood to try to lob it up over the top or to get it in there, rather than under Bjorkren, you would have seen they'd run like wedge sets and Sabonis would get a clean touch at the block. And then if he gets doubled, you can make a play out of that. So yeah, I mean, his turnovers are up, his assists are down, but I think that there's been just a general de-emphasis. His passes are down by about a factor of 20. His touches are down by a factor of 20. You mentioned that stat with Porzingis, like, Brogdon's averaging more touches than Luka right now. So I think it was more like, we're going to be a team that plays through the guards. I think they thought that, you know, if we play five out, that's going to be more open. But my only counter to that would be, they posted Sabonis last year, probably more than what you would ideally want to, but they were number two, one or first or second in drives in the Eastern Conference last year, and second in rim frequency in the NBA. And they were still doing those things. So I think that they both can go hand in hand. I think he can play in five out offense up top, as he showed last year. I just think it's about what spots you're getting him the ball in. And he's a good enough screener that he's a guy that you want out there. The offense is better when he's out there. It's not productive when he isn't. It's just about, I don't really know why they went into this season thinking that the answer for why they could be a better offensive team was de-emphasizing their two-time All-Star, but that's what it seems like to this point in time. It's even stranger when you think about the fact that they've had injuries. Like, if Karras was 100%, TJ Warren was healthy, and Chris Duarte's out there, I get it. Like, you're going to play perhaps more egalitarian, but when they've had so many injuries and then you're seeing him at times defer in bench lineups to guys like, you know, sometimes Brad Wanamaker's out there freelancing, that's when it gets a little bit head scratching to me.
Well, I thought it was funny when you compared his shot distribution to how he was used his rookie season in Oklahoma City, because obviously me and Andrew are Thunder fans, and so we saw that, and then seeing him go to Indiana and become this completely different player from what OKC had imagined him as, and now it seems like it's kind of going back that direction to be more of like this stretch big that he, you know, it didn't seem like he was going there these last couple seasons.
Right. I mean, he was more of a fulcrum for sure under Nate McMillan and Nate Bjorkren than what's been the case so far this year. And again, I understand. I mean, at the start of the season, they talked about in their training camp, they had bells. And if guys made so many shots, you got to go ring the bell. And it was supposed to be an incentive for people to improve their 3-point shooting. And if you're going to have two bigs, you need to be able to space them out. But the natural thing to me has always been, for Miles to be in the Porzingis role, this pick and pop big, who's a floor spacer cutter. And he started to embrace some of that. He's shooting the ball a lot more confidently, and for Sabonis to continue on and doing the things that he's been successful at doing. And sometimes it plays that way and other times it doesn't. But if you had asked me when the season started, hey, will they finish games where Torrey Craig has attempted more shots than Sabonis, I probably would have laughed. And yet that is a thing that has happened.
You mentioned Miles Turner. He's having a great statistical season. He's shooting career best from the field and from three. I think he's up over 41% from three.
Yeah.
And then a career high in rebounds. Are the concerns about the Sabonis-Turner pairing still a big topic of conversation among Pacers fans? And is there a belief in the pairing now with Turner's improved shooting?
I mean, I think it's probably always going to be a topic of conversation as long as they're underperforming, because moving one of them is probably going to be your best mode to upgrading the roster. But yeah, I mean, what you said about Miles, I mean, I think before Nate Bjorkman started last year, I wrote an article about him becoming like an actualized stretch big and how he needed to be able to make better reads, whether to roll or to pop, shoot the ball without hesitating, no second guessing, be able to play off the action so that he wasn't having to make decisions. And then, he's doing all those things. Like, you can watch him now. Guys don't necessarily, like, certain opponents, like when he had 40 against the Wizards, if you watch that game, they're not guarding him. Or when he made 7 or 10 threes against the Knicks, they're not guarding him. So it's very important that he lets the ball go. And if somebody comes at him and rotates as a smaller guard, whether it's stunting or off a switch, you're seeing that he's continuing to shoot the ball. If he's a trailer, he lets the ball go. Whereas in prior seasons, you might have seen him, you know, I missed one or two, I'm going to record scratch out of this. Or, you know, I'm not even going to look at the rim when Rudy Gobert's dropping off of me. And we saw him in Utah, like he made the Jazz pay for that drop coverage a couple times. So he's made strides there. He's been better off 2-point range when he's rolling to the basket. I think that those reads and his complete knowledge of what he needs to be as a power forward in terms of where he finds his cuts has grown over the last 2 years. I can't tell you if he'll continue to shoot the ball this well, but I'm pleased that he's being this confident in what he's doing. And then the next evolution, I think, will be like just as that Knicks game as an example. The first time he went 7-10 from three, Tom Thibodeau's strategy against the Pacers, which is contrary to most of the league, is he'll put the five on Miles and have that guy sag off so that they can converge on Sabonis in the paint. So it was very important that Miles played the way that he did. Well, in this most recent meeting on Monday, they flip-flopped those matchups. So Julius Randle was guarding Miles, and Miles only ended up with, I think, 3 or 4 shots for the game. So I think as the season goes on, if he continues to shoot the ball as well as he is, he's going to have to adjust to teams actually guarding him, which isn't something that we've necessarily seen, but that's brand new to him. But to answer your broader question, yeah, if he can continue to shoot the ball like that, I think that the pairing makes a lot more sense. It's just, how good can this overall team be, and is it still, you know, maybe perhaps the best, like I said at the beginning, the best possible way to upgrade is to potentially move one of them eventually.
I wanted to ask you about Chris Duarte, because before missing a few recent games with an injury, he was having a really nice rookie season, 14-4-2, shooting 40% from three on 5 attempts per game. At draft time, some analysts saw him as a lower ceiling player because of his age. Based on what you've seen so far and his early success, do you think his ceiling may be higher than some thought at draft time?
Yeah, because what's interesting is when you watch him, like, his footwork is so good. And even recently, like at the beginning and then in summer league, you'd see that he always would like sidestep to his left. And now I've seen them getting him the ball on the other side of the floor where he has to go to his right. And he looks good going in both directions, his ability to create space for himself. But sometimes he can rely on that a little bit too much, where you think he could probably get to the rim rather than doing that. So because of that, I think that he's going to continue to grow in his feel, even though he is 24 years old, because he's good at secondary playmaking in a way that the Pacers didn't really have when they had Bojan Bogdanović and Doug McDermott. Like, you can bring Chris Duarte off a stagger and he can put the ball on the floor and potentially hit a roller. But when he's just in pick and roll, he needs to get better at determining the windows of how and when to find Sabonis or Miles. And I think that's going to come because he's already shown progress with that. It's fun when you watch him during games because he always wants to sit next to the coaching staff. He's always asking questions. He seems very inquisitive to try to want to improve. And I think defensively and on the glass, like, he just adds elements that the Pacers didn't really have. So I don't really ever see players in general as a finished product. I mean, even like what we just mentioned with Miles, like, he's 25 and I'm seeing him doing better things this season than what he's done in the past. So I always like to think that there's more room that players can grow. And I think the same for Chris Duarte.
Yeah. So big picture, do you think this roster as currently constructed can be a relevant playoff team in the near future, like win a playoff series? Or if not, what's the biggest immediate need for this roster.
Yeah, so I feel like people should never listen to me again when I answer this question, because when I was asked over the summer, I thought the ceiling was, hey, this could be a six seed because their defense was so problematic last year, and yet it wasn't under Nate McMillan. So I really felt if you can get back to doing that, the offense is probably going to be there. And neither of those things have completely played out. But at the same time, it's like they're constantly having somebody out. Brogdon and LeVert have only played a couple games together. LeVert is still like, he came back from the back injury, then he missed a couple more games for the back injury. I don't know if he's 100%. He's not converting the ball well from the field. So I'd kind of like to see, like, if he's feeling 100% and if TJ Warren ever is back from the mysterious foot injury that's kept him out all this time, what can that group of five players look like? Because anytime one of them's out, they really miss that person, which then causes hesitation for me. Because like what I said before, like they really missed Chris Duarte against the Detroit Pistons. So then it's like, you know, how good can this team really be? And some of it too, like just their resolve isn't always there. I mean, I'm sure you guys probably watched that in those two games this week. Like, it makes me question if the degree of belief is there from this group in themselves, and whether that they really truly think they can gel or not. Cause it just, there's been games this season, that first game against Toronto and they're swarming Sabonis, like they just never had energy from the very tip of the game. And that's true of every NBA team, but it's like when you're already underperforming and you have people that aren't available, you'd like to see more consistency there. And that is one thing that Nate McMillan, like for all the limitations he had in their one and done offense, I never questioned that the effort was going to be there night in and night out, and that they were going to play harder than their opponents. That was a pretty constant thing. And I can't say that of every game so far this season.
Yeah. I had one more question, Al. I just want your thoughts on Rick Carlisle, because everybody thought heading into this season that this was, wow, what a huge upgrade. Rick Carlisle is worth X amount of wins by himself, top three coach in the league. You know, you heard it all. What have your thoughts been about just the early returns on Rick Carlisle?
Right. I mean, I think that obviously after the Bjorkgren situation, they weren't going to take any chances on who they hired the next time. They weren't going to hire another first-time coach, and Rick Carlisle already had ties to Indiana. That's definitely who the fan base wanted. So it was going to be a pretty easy hire, I think, for Kevin Pritchard to make. And I would never pretend that I know more about basketball than he does. He's won a title. He clearly knows a ton about offense. And this system worked in Dallas. Like, let's face it, like 2 years ago, Dallas had a historically great offense. But there are times where I watch it and I think to myself similar things that I thought when I watched Bjorkgren's system last year defensively. Like, it was a copy and paste from the Raptors, and it was like, hey, you're kind of coaching the team you want, not necessarily the team you have. And there's sometimes this year where I feel like some of the turnovers are sloppy and that just players need to pay more attention. But I think some of them are a product too of like, is that what's happening on offense? That it's a little bit more of the five out system that he wants rather than necessarily the players that they have. I think, but my main criticism would be what I mentioned earlier, that there's times early in the year, like when they played the Miami Heat, you could see down the stretch that like Brogdon and Sabonis had leeway where they would be signaling Spain action. They would be calling plays into overtime. And here over the last week or two, especially because my audio has been messed up, he's calling plays a lot. Like it feels a little bit micromanaged to me, especially in these last two fourth quarters where it's like, you know, LeVert's kind of a guy who needs to have a little bit more freedom. And while he and Brogdon certainly could have been moving the ball more against New York, I don't think it was helpful against that defense to be having them stop and look at the bench for plays and then go into it. And that's not because the plays are bad. Like, a lot of them are good. I wrote one this week about a play that works for them almost every time they run it, and how all five players are moving and touching the ball. So I think that a lot of the sets are good. They have a lot of wrinkles, a lot of counters that are smart, but that would be my main criticism, is like they kind of let go of Nate Bjorkgren because he was micromanaging. And I think that shows up at times on both ends of the floor so far this year. And the improvements that they need to make on defense haven't consistently been there yet.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV.
claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, Caleb, thank you so much for answering our questions about this strange team. But it is now time to play Andrew versus the Beat, our weekly trivia show where Andrew goes head-to-head against an NBA beat writer. This week, of course, Caitlin Cooper, writer at Indy Cornrows. Caitlin, how this works, I came up with 8 questions about the Pacers. You will give me a number between 1 and 8. That will correspond to a question. It may be easy, it may be hard. If you get it right, you get 2 points. If you get it wrong, Andrew will have a chance to steal for 1. We'll go back and forth until all questions have been asked and answered. So start me off with a question, or start me off with a number between 1 and 8.
2.
Question number 2. In 2008-2009, Danny Granger became the first player in NBA history to increase his scoring average by at least 5 points per game in 3 consecutive seasons. Which NBA player accomplished that same feat within the last 5 years?
Part of me thinks this is going to be wrong, but it's probably my Pacer bias. Is it Victor Oladipo?
Victor Oladipo. Now, I'm going to double check that one because that is not one of the ones I looked up. Let me make sure. Here we go. That is incorrect. He went from, he did have a big jump from 16 to 23 points, but he was never lower than that significantly.
Okay,
Andrew, you have a chance to steal for 1 point. This player increased their scoring average. Yes. What was that?
The name I can't stop thinking is Pascal Siakam, so I'll say Pascal Siakam.
Andrew, that is absolutely correct. Yeah, like Shea, Jaylen Brown. There are a bunch of guys who are so close. They were within like 1 point of accomplishing this. Okay, Andrew, you're up 1-0. It is your time to choose number.
Number one.
Which player on the current Pacers roster has the most NBA experience? There's only 17 guys. Andrew, you can go through them real quick. You got your Rolodex of Pacers players.
17 guys. Is this, is this Jeremy Lamb?
It is Jeremy Lamb, the longest. He's been in the league the longest out of all the Pacers players. Okay, back to Caitlin.
Let's do number 6.
Number 6. Who is the only Pacer to have ever led the league in triple-doubles?
Yeah, this is tricky because Sabonis has the most in franchise history, but he wouldn't have had more than Westbrook last year when he had the most. Lance Stephenson had like 4 in a season, but I doubt he had more than Westbrook either. So I'm trying to think what other Pacers would have had a lot of triple-doubles. Let's go with Detlef Schrempf.
Detlef Schrempf. That is incorrect.
I'm doing really good.
Andrew, you have a chance to steal for 1 point. Who's the only Pacer?
I'll just say Lance. I have no idea.
Andrew, it was
so
Lance.
I gave the answer away?
You did, Caitlin. He had 5. Right, he had 5 one season, and apparently that was the most in the league that year. It must have been probably the 2013-14 season.
No, it was 2013.
It would have been 2013-14.
Okay.
13-14 when Russell's out.
Well, that's where I made the mistake. I knew he was close that year because there was a lot of controversy over whether he was going to make an All-Star team in Indiana or not, but I should have gone with my gut instinct, Lance.
You should have. I told you I learned something from you. I've even learned something from you just sitting here recording this trivia show.
Okay, Andrew, you have a commanding lead. You can extend that lead.
3.
Question number 3. In 1998, the Indiana Pacers became the first team in NBA history to double the score of their opponent in a game, beating this Western Conference playoff team 124-59. So I have narrowed it down for you. All you have to do is remember which Western Conference teams made the playoffs in 1998 and then pick one of them.
I just have zero idea about this one. I'll just say the Lakers.
The Lakers. That is incorrect. Caitlin, you have a chance to steal.
I don't know. The Jazz.
The Jazz, another good guess, but no, that was incorrect. It was the Portland Trailblazers. Portland Trailblazers. 124-59.
Wow.
Okay, Caitlin, it's your turn.
Let's do number five.
Question number five. No pacer. And by the way, this is one of the rare questions. This could actually have the potential to be worth 3 points. 3 points. Mm. No pacer has ever made an all-NBA first team. How many have made an all-NBA second team? So for the 2 points, you just have to tell me the number. How many Pacers have made an all-NBA second team? For a bonus point, you tell me the name or names.
Okay. Reggie, Jermaine, Paul George. I know Oladipo did, so that's four. I'm thinking Ron Artest might have, or I guess we should call him Meta Sandiford. Is that what he's calling himself now? I'm going to say five, and those are the five.
Now, this is all NBA second team.
Oh, second team. Second team. Okay, Victor did not make second team. So, yeah, that I was thinking all NBA at all. So, that's tougher then. How many Pacers made a second team? And you said nobody made a first team.
Correct.
Oh. Let's go with Paul George. I'm pretty sure he made a second team. Reggie, I'm going to guess, because I know he made it multiple times, so maybe he made a second team at one point in time. And I'm feeling good about Jermaine, so let's just do three.
Okay. That is incorrect. Andrew, you have a chance to steal. Tell me the number of Pacers who have made an all-NBA second team. And bonus point, if you can give me the name or names.
Four?
Four. What if I told you it was one? Only one Pacer has ever made a first or second All-NBA team, and it was Jermaine O'Neal.
Well, I know that the people I said at least made one All-NBA team.
They did.
That is wild.
A bunch of them, like Reggie Miller, Ron Artest, Paul George, Victor Oladipo, all made an NBA third team. And then Jermaine O'Neal actually made two All-NBA third teams, but he was the only one who has made an All-NBA second team. Wow.
That's crazy.
Okay, Andrew, three questions left. Four, seven, and eight.
Number four.
Question number four. Reggie Miller holds the franchise record for most minutes played with over 47,000 minutes played as a Pacer. The next closest Pacer played less than half as many minutes for the team with 23,100 minutes. Who is second all time in minutes played for the Pacers?
Man, I don't know. Rick Smits? I have no idea.
Rick Smits. Andrew, how are you cheating? That is correct. It was
no,
Rick Smits.
That's what I was going to guess.
Why would you have thought of Rick Smits?
I just think he's just Pacer. Like, he's just whatever he is Pacer.
I was just going to pick him because I knew he had a lot of consecutive seasons with the Pacers, which isn't true for a lot of people. So,
like, yeah, you think about Jermaine wasn't there for that long. Like, that whole crew wasn't there for very long. Then you think like Paul George, like, no, like Roy Hibbert wouldn't have been. I don't know. There's just not a lot of like long tenured Pacers.
Okay, Caitlin, we have questions seven and eight left. Which would you like to go?
Let's go with number seven.
Number seven. The Indiana Pacers have had nine different players participate in the NBA Slam Dunk Contest, and we are going to try to name them all. So how this works, Caitlin, you'll give me a name, then Andrew, you'll give me a name. We'll go back and forth until one of you stumbles or until we name all nine Pacers who have been in the Slam Dunk Contest. So Caitlin, start us off with a name.
Cassius Stanley.
Cassius Stanley. Wait, when was
last
he in
year.
It?
Last year.
Oh, yes, that's correct. There are 10. There are 10 Pacers. I have to add that one on.
Fred Jones.
Fred Jones, that is correct. Back to Caitlin.
Victor Oladipo.
Victor Oladipo, that is correct. Back to Andrew. Pacers in the slam dunk.
They were a Pacer when they were in the slam dunk contest?
Correct.
Or they were... Okay.
Yeah, when they were a Pacer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I don't know why I'm blanking now.
You don't really think of the Pacers as like a high-flying slam dunk team, but they've had a lot more than a lot of other teams.
I don't know.
Okay, okay. Andrew's right giving now. Up. Caitlin, here's what I'm going to do. every name you can give me from here on out, I'm going to give you 1 point. And we'll see how many you can get right. So these are Pacers that were in the slam dunk contest.
Paul George was in it.
That is correct.
Glenn Robinson III was in it.
That is correct.
Oh. You already said Fred Jones, which was going to be my other go-to. Wow. I'm trying to think, because Paul George was in it more than once. That should count as two, but I'm trying to think who else. I mean, Gerald Green was in it, but not when he was a Pacer, I don't think. I don't think I...
Yeah, he's a Timberwolf.
No, I think he was in it when he was a Celtic. I can't think of another one off the top of my head. I'm surprised there's eight.
I was also surprised there was eight. Would you believe that Gerald Green was a Pacer?
I need to stop saying answers.
Yeah.
It was the, from what I can tell, it was the 2013
okay.
slam dunk competition.
Weird.
So you got two names plus the two for the question. That gets you to four. The other names, Jonathan Bender, Antonio Davis, and then Kenny Williams and Terrence Stansbury.
No, I would not have gotten
anyone
those.
To get those. Yeah. Okay, final question. Andrew, you get first crack at it. The Pacers have had five different players win the Most Improved Player Award, which is tied with this NBA team for the most winners from one team. So the Pacers and this team have had the most amount of Most Improved Player Award winners.
The Bucks?
The Bucks. That is incorrect. Kalen, any guesses?
Too bad. I know who the five Pacers are that were Most Improved Player. Let's see. What is another team that would have the Pacers type mentality of finding guys who are unloved and then come and play for the Pacers and get better? Let's say... I don't know. The Bulls. I know Jimmy Butler won it there.
So the correct team was the Orlando Magic, which I don't even know if I would have thought of them. And listen to these names. You got Scott Skiles, Daryl Armstrong, Tracy McGrady, Hedo Turkoglu, and Ryan Anderson.
I know when I think of that award, wild. Ryan Anderson and Hedo Turkoglu are the first two people I think of.
Really?
Right. I know. Yeah, no kidding.
All right, Andrew, you have won. You have won Pacers Week on Andrew versus the Beat.
Yes.
Thank you, Caitlin, for playing us.
Thank you for...
Caitlin,
glad I
thanks
gave
so
away
much.
A lot of answers without getting very many points.
I know. I was going to say, Caitlin, I could have done it without you. Thank
no
you so
problem.
Much.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, we're so thankful that you came on. Go follow Caitlin on Twitter at C2_Cooper. You can read her on IndieCornrows.com. If you want to be a smarter NBA fan, go read Caitlin. Thanks, Caitlin.
Talk to you guys later.
All right, Andrew, we're not spinning the wheel this week. Next week, we are going to do the Charlotte Hornets. We're pushing them back a week because next week is Thanksgiving. And so we're going to record earlier in the week, and therefore we're going to do more of a evergreen show. So we're going to delay the Hornets for 2 weeks. Next week, we'll still have a show. And then we'll get back on track with our Wheel of Fandom in 2 weeks.
Well, with no wheel, Al, we're going to go to some iTunes reviews, or I guess Apple Podcast reviews. This first one is from at J. Holla Milf Money, which is just a great name. He says, Saturday Slam and Jam. Not only is the Saturday Slam and Jam the best on the Athletic NBA show, it's one of the best NBA podcasts out there, period. When I have a busy week and can't watch as much NBA as I'd like... As I'd like to, I always know Andrew and Alex will put in the work for me and catch me up on my day off. It's so nice to have it to look forward to each week. Thank you so much for that review. And then we have another one from at Hammering Hamp. It says, Saturday is the day. I've listened to every day this pod has to offer, but there is only one that keeps it fresh and interesting for a casual like me. The Saturday Slam and Jam. Always original analysis, great repertoire, and nail-biting trivia makes this the most entertaining pod on the esteemed Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up the great work. Wow. Very nice reviews. If you want to have your review read on the pod, leave us 5 stars, mention the Slam and Jam, and we will also read it right here on the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy Thanksgiving and all the festivities that that includes here in the U.S. And we will talk to you guys again next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.